What is he digging then?
Long Bill asked. He was too nearsighted to see clearly what young Call saw. He's digging a grave, Call said. The ranger troop approached, but too slowly to suit Bigfoot Wallace. He'd already cut the blackened corpses of the two mule skinners loose from the wagon wheels where they had been tied. Though he had smelled burned human flesh before, he didn't like to smell it. He was anxious to get the burying over with in case the Indians who had burned two men chose to come back and try him. "Are you men praying? If you ain't, get down and help me," he said impatiently.
"Oh, Lord, look,"
Rip Green said. He barely was off his horse before he began to puke. Gus didn't dare look, really. He threw the briefest glance at the two blackened corpses and turned his eyes away. Even so, his stomach rose. He rode off a few steps, hoping to get the smell out of his nostrils before he had to dismount and puke like Rip. Call got down and immediately began to help Bigfoot. He tried not to look at the two corpses, but could not help seeing that their teeth were bared in the agony in which they died. There were ashes in front of the wagon wheels they had been tied to. A twist of smoke still rose in front of the fires. Call did have a good knife. Old Jesus had forged it for him, sharpened it carefully, and bound the handle with tight rawhide. Call dug hard. It was the only way he could keep his mind off what had happened to the two men. One of the burned wagons was still smoldering. It was only then, when he glanced up, that he noticed that the prairie around the wagon was white. The two mule skinners had been hauling flour, and the Indians had ripped up the sacks and scattered the flour on the grass.
Lordy, these boys weren't lucky,
Long Bill observed philosophically, walking around the scene of the torture. Nope, and they weren't prepared either, Bigfoot said. I guess that old shotgun was the only weapon they had with them. He nodded toward the shotgun, which had been broken in two on a large rock that stuck up from the ground.
I wouldn't set off with a load of flour or nothing to defend myself with except a fowling piece, not in this country,
Blackie Slidell remarked.
There's empty sacks in that other wagon that ain't too burned, Bigfoot said. Go get a few, Gus, and roll these men in them. We need to move out. I'll make it about 9 Indians that cook these men, and one of them was Buffalo Hump.
Did you see him?
Johnny Carthage asked, turning white. All the rangers touched their weapons to make sure they were still there. No, but he's still riding that painted pony he rode that day he killed Josh and Zeke, Bigfoot said. I studied his track in case I ever had to fight him again, and his track is all around these wagons.
Oh, Lord, I was afraid it was him,
Rip Green said. He was white and shaky. Johnny Carthage knew a little cobbling. He'd been offered a job making shoes in San Antonio. Looking at the two burned wagoneers, their bodies blackened and swollen, their teeth bared in terrible grimaces, he wondered why he hadn't had the good sense to take the job. Cobbling down by the San Antonio River had a lot to recommend it. It wasn't exciting, but neither would it expose you to the risk of being caught on the open prairie, roped to a wagon wheel, and burned to death. Of course, he could go back and take the job. The old cobbler liked him, but he was already a long ride out of San Antonio and would run the very risk he wanted to avoid if he tried to go back alone.
I wish there was more timber on this road, Blackie Slidell said. I don't know if we could whip 9 of those rascals if they came charging and we had nothing to hide behind.
9's about the right size for a raiding party, Bigfoot observed. He'd about finished his digging. The grave wasn't deep enough, but it would have to do. Why? Call asked. Why what? Bigfoot replied. The youngster was a good digger, and besides, he was steady. Of all the troop, he was the least affected by the sight of the charred bodies. Of course, Long Bill wasn't shaking or puking, but Long Bill was notorious for his bad eyesight. He probably hadn't come close enough to take a good look. Why is 9 a good size? Call asked as Gus handed him an armful of sacks. He spread one layer of sacking over each man, and then rolled the bodies over and tucked another layer of sacking over their backsides. It was curious how stiff bodies got. The dead men's limbs were as stiff as wood. 9's about right, Bigfoot said, impressed that young Call was eager to learn even while performing an unpleasant task. 9 men who know the country can slip between the settlements without being noticed. They can watch the settlers and figure out which farms to attack. If there's a family with 4 or 5 big strapping boys who look like they can shoot, they'll leave it and go on to one where there's mostly women folk. Matilda Roberts stood looking at the corpses as Carl and Gus finished covering them with sacking. She recognized one of the men. His name was Eli, and he'd come to her more than once. "The nearest one is Eli Baker," she said. "He worked in the flour mill. I know him by his ear." "What about his ear?" Bigfoot asked. "Look at it before you rake the dirt over him," Matilda said. "He got half his ear cut off when he was a boy, the bottom half. That's Eli Baker for sure. We ought to try to get word to his family. I believe he had several young'uns."
"And a wife?" Bigfoot asked.
"Well, he didn't have the young'uns himself," Matilda said. "I ain't seen him in a year or two, but I know he's Eli Baker." When the corpses were covered, everyone stood around awkwardly for a minute. The wide prairie was empty, though the tall grass sang from the breeze. The sun shone brilliantly. Bigfoot took the stock of the broken shotgun and tamped the dirt solidly over the grave of the two wagoneers.
"If anybody knows a good scripture, let them say it," Bigfoot said. "We need to skedaddle. I'd rather not have to race no Comanches today. My horse is lame."
"There's that scripture about the green pastures," Long Bill recalled. "It's about the Lord being a shepherd."
"So say it then, Bill," Bigfoot said. He caught his horse and waited impatiently to mount. Long Bill was silent.
"Well, there's the green pastures," he said. "That's all I can recall. It's been a while since I had any dealings with scriptures."
"Can anyone say it?" Bigfoot asked.
"Leadeth me beside the still waters," Matilda said. "I think that's the one Bill's talking about."
"Well, this is a green pasture at least," Bigfoot said. "It'll be greener if it keeps raining."
"I wonder why people want to say scriptures when they've buried somebody," Carl reflected to Gus as they were trotting on toward Austin. "They're dead. They can't hear no holy talk." Gus had the scared feeling inside again. The Indian who had nearly brought him down with a lance was somewhere around. He might be tracking them, or watching them, even then. He might be anywhere with his warriors. They were approaching a little copse of live oak trees thick enough to conceal a party of Comanches. What if Buffalo Hump and his warriors suddenly burst out, yelling their terrible war cries? Would he be able to shoot straight? Would he have the guts to fire a bullet through his eyeball if the battle went against them? Would he end up burned, swollen, and stiff like the two men they had just buried? Those were the important questions when you were out on the prairie where the wild men lived. Why people said scriptures over the dead was not an issue he could concentrate his mind on, not when he had the scared feeling in his stomach. Even if he could have had the pork chop his mouth had been watering for the night before, he had no confidence that he could have kept it down.
"It's the custom," he said finally. "People get to thinking of heaven when people die."
Carl didn't answer. He was wondering what the mule skinners were thinking and feeling when the Comanches tied them to the wagon wheels and began to build fires under them. Were they thinking of angels, or just wishing they could be dead? "As soon as we get to Austin, I want to buy a better gun," he said. "I mean to practice, too. If we're going on this expedition, we need to learn to shoot." Toward evening, the sky darkened again toward the southwest. Once again, the sky turned coal black with only a thin line of light at the horizon. The rolls of thunder were so loud that the rangers had to give up conversation.
"It might be another cyclone," Blackie yelled. "We need to look for a gully or a ditch."
This time, though, no twisting snake cloud formed, though a violent thunderstorm slashed at them for some 15 minutes, drenching them all. They expected a wet, cold night, but by good fortune came upon a big live oak tree that lightning had just struck. The tree had been split right in two. Part of the tree was still blazing when the rain began to diminish. It made a good hot fire and enabled everybody to strip off and dry their clothes. Matilda, far from shy, stripped off first. Carl was reluctant to take all his clothes off in her presence, but Gus wasn't. He didn't have a cent, but hoped that the sight of him would incline Matilda to be friendly, or a little more than friendly, later in the evening, a hope that was disappointed. Bigfoot had Buffalo Hump on his mind. There was a time for sport and a time to keep a close watch. None of the rangers slept much, but the blazing fire was some comfort. By midnight, when it was Carl's turn to watch, the sky was cloudless and the stars shone bright.
Caleb Cobb and his sour captain, Billy Falconer, enlisted the 6 rangers for the expedition against New Mexico immediately. The rangers simply walked up to the hotel where the enlistments were being handled and the matter was done. Billy Falconer was a dark little snipe of a man with quick eyes, but Caleb Cobb was large. To call, he appeared slow.
He stood a good 6'5" and had long, flowing blonde hair. On the table in front of him, when he cast his lazy gaze over the men who hoped to go with him on the expedition, were two Walker Colt pistols, the latest thing in weaponry. Call would have liked one of the Walkers. At least he would have liked to hold one and heft it, though of course he knew that such fine guns were far beyond his means.
"There's no wages. This is volunteer soldiering," Caleb Cobb pointed out at once. "All we furnish is ammunition and grub."
"When possible, we expect you to wrestle your own grub at that," Captain Falconer said. Caleb Cobb had a deep voice. He kept a deck of cards in his hand and shuffled them endlessly.
"This is a free man's army, only we won't call it an army," Caleb said.
"I wouldn't call it an army anyway if these fellows outside the hotel are specimens of the soldiers," Bigfoot said.
Caleb Cobb smiled, or half-smiled. Billy Falconer's eyes darted everywhere, whereas Caleb scarcely opened his. He leaned back in a big chair and watched the proceedings as if half asleep.
"Mainly we're a trading expedition, Mr. Wallace," Caleb Cobb said after a moment. "St. Louis has had the Santa Fe business long enough. Some of us down here in the Texas Republic think we ought to go up there and capture a bunch of it for ourselves."
"That crowd outside is mostly bankers and barbers," Bigfoot said. "If they want to trade, that's fine, but what are we going to do for fighting men if the Mexicans decide they don't like our looks?"
"That ain't your worry, that's ours," Captain Falconer snapped.
"It's mine if I'm taking my scalp over in that direction," Bigfoot said.
"Why, we'll gather up some fighters here and there," Caleb said. "Captain Billy Falconer is such a firebrand, I expect he could handle a Mexican army all by himself."
"If he's such a scrapper, then let him go handle Buffalo Hump," Bigfoot suggested. "He and his boys cooked 2 mule skinners yesterday, not 30 miles from this hotel."
"Why, the ugly rascal," Falconer said, grabbing one of the Walker Colts.
"I'll get up a party and go after him right now. You boys can come if you're game."
"Whoa now, Billy," Caleb Cobb said. "You can go chase violent Comanches if you want to, but you ain't taking one of my new pistols. That humpback man might get the best of you, and then I'd be out of gun."
"Oh, I thought one of these was mine," Falconer said.
He put the gun back on the table with a sheepish look.
"It ain't," Cobb said, sitting up a little straighter.
Then he looked at Bigfoot again and let his sleepy eyes drift over the troop. Call didn't like the man's manner. He considered it insolent. But he was conscious that he and Gus were the youngest men in the troop. It was not his place to speak.
"When are we leaving, then?" Bigfoot asked. "Day after tomorrow, if General Lloyd gets here," Caleb said. "The roads down Houston way are said to be muddy. They're generally muddy. I guess the general may be stuck."
"General Lloyd?" Bigfoot asked, a little surprised.
"I scouted for the man a few years back. Why are we taking a general if this is a trading expedition?"
"It never hurts to have a general in tow, especially if you're dealing with Mexicans," Caleb said. "They like to deal with the jefe, in my experience. If they get rumptious, we can hang a few medals on Phil Lloyd and send him in to parley with the governor of Santa Fe. It might spare us some hostilities." "I'd rather avoid hostilities if we can," Caleb added, shuffling his cards.
"I'd rather avoid them myself. We'll be outnumbered 50-1, Bigfoot commented. "The reason General Lloyd ain't here is because he got drunk and got lost. The man was dead drunk the whole time I scouted for him, and he got lost every time he stepped out of his tent to piss. He couldn't find Mexico if you pointed him south and gave him a year. And what's more, he can't ride."
Caleb Cobb chuckled.
"Well, he can ride in a wagon, and if he can't, we'll tie him in," he said.
"Our mounts are a little on the feeble side," Long Bill put in. "What do we do about horses?"
"You look like seasoned men," Caleb said. "The Republic of Texas will furnish you a horse apiece. Billy, sign them some chits. Half the men in Austin are horse traders. I expect you can find good mounts."
"What about guns? Mine's a poor weapon," Carl asked. "I would like to replace it, if possible, before we leave."
"Guns are your lookout," Captain Falconer snapped. "If you're Rangers, I guess you're drawing Rangers' pay. You can buy your own guns."
"No, I think some new guns would be a sound investment, Billy," Caleb said. "I expect the Mexicans will welcome us with open arms and probably cook a few goats and lay us out a feast, but folks are unpredictable. If the Mexicans get fractious, it would be good if we're well armed so we can shoot the damn bastards. Tell the quartermaster to help these gentlemen arm themselves proper.
So what's our route, Colonel? Bigfoot inquired. You're too full of questions. We ain't figured out the route, Falconer snapped. We ain't got all day to stand around talking either.
Captain Falconer briskly wrote them out some chits for horses, good with any trader in Austin, he claimed, and then marched them over to a man named Brognoli, who was in charge of stores and armaments. Brognoli was in the process of buying livestock when they found him. 20 beeves had been driven in. They were ambling around the town square, which at that time was a maelstrom of activity. A wagon master was hammering together a new wagon, several saddle makers were making repairs on saddles the volunteers had brought in, and a dentist was pulling a man's tooth right in the middle of it all. The man yowled, but the dentist persisted and brought out a tooth with a long red root.
I'll be damned if I'd let a man stick pliers in my mouth and pull out my teeth, Gus said as they walked through the crowd.
Horses, mules, sheep, pigs, and chickens crowded the square. Call had never been in the midst of so much activity before. He felt a little hemmed in. There was so much to see that it was more than a little confusing. So engrossed was the quartermaster Brognoli in purchasing livestock that it was half an hour before he could attend to their request for guns. When he did get time for them, he proved to be a friendly man.
Muskets are what I've got. I've not been issued pistols, he said. The muskets will do for buffalo or Indians either.
He took them into a storeroom behind a large general store. Cases of muskets were stacked on top of one another. While Carl and the others were hefting various rifles and looking at ammunition pouches, Gus happened to peek into the store itself. There was a girl standing there by a counter, who was so lovely that Gus immediately forgot all about cap and ball muskets, ammunition pouches, and everything else. The girl seemed to work in the store. She was helping an old lady try on a sunbonnet. The girl was slim. She had the liveliest expression. Also, she was alert. Gus had merely glanced at her, supposing that she was too busy to notice, but she caught his glance and looked at him so directly that it unnerved him. He would have retreated back to the muskets had she not immediately smiled at him in a quick, friendly way. Emboldened by that smile, Gus abandoned his comrades and walked into the store. It was a big, high-ceilinged store filled with every kind of goods, from hammers and nails to fine headwear. He couldn't resist trying on a new gray hat with a sweeping brim, though he knew he couldn't afford it. He could hear the old lady chattering on. She was in no hurry to choose her sunbonnet. Twice Gus decided the young woman was so busy with the old harpy that he could risk another glance or two, but both times he risked it, the girl caught the glance as if it were a ball he had tossed her. She didn't allow his glances to distract her from her work, but she didn't fail to notice them either. Gus proceeded to examine a case full of knives. He had always had a strong fondness for knives. Some of the ones in the case would have excited him a lot on any other day. They had gleaming blades with handles of ivory or horn, but compared to the pretty girl selling sunbonnets, knives were of little interest. When the old lady finally chose her sunbonnet and paid for it, Gus was trying to work up his nerve to say good morning to the girl. But before he had it worked up, there was another interruption. A brusque little man in a black frock coat bustled in and went straight to the cigars.
"Morning, Miss Forsyth," the fellow said. "I'm here for my cigar."
"Here it is, Dr. Morris," the girl said. "We've already got it wrapped up. My father tended to it personally."
"Yes, but he attended to it too well,"
the little doctor said, quickly tearing the wrapping off the little package the girl handed him. He extracted a long cigar and pulled it slowly under his nose.
"Never buy a cigar without smelling it," he advised the girl.
Then he tipped his hat and walked out, the cigar jutting out of his mouth. "I guess that was good advice," the young woman said, strolling over to Gus. "But I won't take it."
"Well, why wouldn't you?"
Gus asked, amazed that the young woman had simply walked over and addressed him.
"Because I don't fancy cigars," the girl said with a smile. Then she thrust the wadded-up paper from the doctor's package into his hand.
"Here, dispose of this, sir," she said with a fetching smile.
"Do what?"
Gus asked, paralyzed with anxiety lest he'd do something wrong and scare the girl away, though he had to admit she didn't look easily scared.
"Dispose of this paper. I can see that you're tall, but I don't know if you're useful," the girl said. "I'm Clara. Who are you?"
"Augustus McCrae," Gus said. Though he rarely used his full name, he felt that on this occasion it would be proper.
"Augustus, did you hear that? He's Roman like you, Mr. Brognoli. Clara said, addressing the quartermaster, who had stepped into the store for the moment to give her chits for the muskets.
"I don't think so, Miss Forsythe," Brognoli said, tipping his cap to the girl. "I think he's just a young rascal from Tennessee. You better get your musket. You'll need it where you're going," he added, looking at Gus. "What's that in your hand? You ain't been stealing from Miss Forsythe, have you?"
"Oh, no. It's just some wrapping I asked him to dispose of," Clara said. "I like to find out quick if a man's useful or not. So far, he ain't disposed of it. I guess that means he's a laggard."
"Hold this. I aim to keep it forever," Gus said, flushed with embarrassment.
Brognoli had already turned and disappeared. He was alone with Clara Forsythe, who was watching him out of two keen eyes.
"Keep it forever? That scrap?" Clara said. "Why would you do such a foolish thing as that, Mr. McCrae? You have important soldiering to do. I expect you'll need both hands."
"I'll keep it because you gave it to me," Gus said.
Clara stopped smiling and looked at him calmly. The speech didn't seem to surprise her, though it greatly surprised Gus. He had not meant to say anything of the sort, but such a feeling had risen in him because of Clara Forsythe that he couldn't move his limbs or control his speech.
"Here, don't you want to pick a gun?" Call asked, sticking his head in the store for a moment. He saw Gus standing by a girl and supposed he was trying to buy something he couldn't afford and didn't need, whereas he did need a gun.
"You pick one for me. I expect it will do," Gus said, determined not to leave Miss Forsythe's presence until he absolutely had to.
"We're going to buy horses. Don't you want to pick your own mount?"
Call asked, a little puzzled by his friend's behavior.
He looked again at the young shop girl and saw that she was unusually pretty. Perhaps that explained it. Still, they were about to set off on a long, dangerous expedition. Choosing the right gun and right mount could mean life or death once they were out on the prairies. If he was at taking with a shop girl, he could come back later and chatter. Though for once, Gus wasn't chattering. He was just standing there, as if planted to the floor, holding some scraps of paper in his hand. It was unusual behavior. Carl stepped into the store, thinking his friend might be sick. He tipped his straw hat to the pretty shop girl as he approached.
"Hello. Are you a Roman too, sir?" Clara asked with a smile.
Carl was stumped. He didn't understand the question. The young woman's look was so direct that it startled him. What did it mean to be a Roman, and why had she asked?
"No, this is Woodrow Carl. He's a plain Texan," Gus said. "I don't know how that fella knew I was from Tennessee."
In fact, Brognoli's comment had irked him. What right had a quartermaster to be speculating with Miss Forsythe about where he was from?
"Why, Mr. Brognoli's a traveled man," Clara said. "He's been telling me about Europe. I mean to go there some day and see the sights."
"If it's farther off than Santa Fe, I doubt I'll have time to go," Carl said.
He found that he didn't feel awkward talking to the shop girl. She was so friendly that talking was easy, even though he had no idea where Europe was or what sights might be there for a young lady to see.
Carl was impatient, though. They had to outfit themselves for a great expedition, and they only had a day to do it. He glanced around the big store and saw that it contained goods of every description, many of which would probably be useful on their expedition, but their chits only covered guns and horses. It was pointless to waste time looking around a big store when they had no money to spend at all, yet Gus seemed reluctant to move.
"I'll be along, Woodrow. I'll be along," Gus said. "Just grab me a musket as you leave."
"Why, I believe I've smitten Mr. McCrae," Clara said with a laugh. "I doubt I could smite you, though, Mr. Call, not unless I had a club."
With no more said, she turned and began to unpack a large box of dry goods. Call turned and left, a little puzzled by the shop girl's remark. Why would she want to smite him with a club? She seemed a friendly girl, though the meaning of her remark was hard to puzzle out. Clara whistled a tune as she unpacked the big box of dry goods. She glanced up after a bit and saw that Augustus McCrae, the young Tennessean, was still exactly where he had been when she last addressed him.
"Hey, you, go along," she said. "Your friend Mr. Call is waiting."
"No, he ain't waiting," Gus said. "He left with the boys."
"Are you really a Texas Ranger?" Clara asked. "I've not met too many Texas Rangers. My father says they're rascals mostly. Are you a rascal, Mr. McCrae?"
Gus hardly knew how to respond to such a barrage of questions.
"I may have done a rascally thing or two," Gus said. Since Clara was so frank, he decided honesty might be the best policy.
She was smiling when she looked at him, which was puzzling. "Here, since you're still around, put this cotton over on that bench," she said. "It's got mussed up somewhere along the way. I expect we'll have to wash it before we can sell it. Folks around here won't pay money for cotton goods that look mussed." Gus took the swatch of cotton cloth and put it where she had told him to. An old man in a brown coat came in while she was doing it. The old man had on a gray hat and had a patch over one eye. He looked a little surprised to see a stranger carrying his dry goods around. "Hi, Pa. This is Mr. Augustus McCrae of Tennessee," Clara said merrily. "He's a Texas Ranger, but he seems to have time to spare, so I put him right to work."
"I see," Mr. Forsythe said. He shook Gus's hand and looked at Clara, his daughter, with great fondness. "She's brash, ain't she?" he said to Gus. "You don't need to wait for an opinion. If Clara's around, she'll get you an opinion before you can catch your breath."
Clara was still unpacking goods, whistling as she worked. She had her sleeves rolled up, exposing her pretty wrists.
"Well, I must go look at them horses," Gus said. "Many thanks for the visit."
"Was it a visit?" Clara said, giving him one of her direct glances.
"Seemed like one," Gus said.
He felt the remark was inadequate, but couldn't think of another.
"That door ain't locked. You can come back and pitch in with the unpacking, Mr. McCrae, if you have time," Clara said.
Old man Forsythe chuckled. "If he doesn't have it, he'll make it," he said, putting his arm around his daughter's shoulder for a moment.
Gus tipped his hat to both of them and walked out the front door, the scraps of wrapping paper still in his hand. Once out of Clara's sight, he carefully folded the brown paper and put it in his breast pocket. Although he had left the general store and was back amid the throng of peddlers and merchants, all hoping to profit from the coming expedition, in his mind, Gus still stood by the big box of dry goods, waiting for Clara Forsythe to hand him another swatch of cloth. Call, who was standing with Long Bill and Blackie Slidell not 20 yards away, had to yell at him 3 times to get his attention.
"Here, I hope you're pleased with this musket," Call said when Gus finally strolled over. "It's new, and it's got a good heft. I don't know what we'll do about pistols. Mr. Brognoli says they're costly."
"I don't want to go," Gus said flatly. "I wonder if that girl's pa would hire me to work in that store."
"What?" Call said, shocked. "You don't want to go on the expedition?"
"No, I'd rather marry that girl," Gus said.
Long Bill and Blackie Slidell thought it was the funniest joke of the year. They laughed so hard that the dentist, who was about to pull another tooth out of another customer, stopped his work for a moment in amazement. Call, however, was embarrassed for his friend. The expedition to Santa Fe was a serious matter. They were Rangers. They had to defend the Republic. Yet Gus had just walked into a store to select a musket, spotted a girl with a frank manner, and now wanted to quit rangering. "Marry her? You haven't got a cent," Call said. "Anyway, why would she have you? You ain't known her 10 minutes.
10 minutes is enough," Gus said. "I want to marry her, and I aim to."
"He's a cutter, ain't he?" Long Bill commented. "Meets a girl, and the next thing you know, he's off to hunt a preacher."
"Well, you heard me," Gus said. "I aim to marry her, and that's that."
"No, now you can't. That's desertion," Blackie pointed out. "You signed your mark this morning right in front of Caleb Cobb. I expect he'd hang you on the spot if you tried to quit."
The remark had a sobering effect. Gus had totally forgotten signing his mark and putting himself under military command. He had forgotten most of his life prior to meeting Clara. The fact that he could be executed for changing his mind had never occurred to him.
"Well, that marking don't amount to much," Gus said. He didn't want to be hanged, but he also didn't want to leave Austin now that he had found the woman he intended to marry.
"You need to visit the whorehouse. It will clear your head," Long Bill said. "My head's cloudy, too. I say we all go once we've picked our horses."
"I don't want no whore," Call said. But in fact, once they picked their horses and bought a slicker apiece, they all went down by the river where several whores were working out of a shanty. There were 6 stalls with blankets hung between them. Gus chose a Mexican girl and did his business quickly. Once he was done, even as he was buckling his pants, he still thought of Clara Forsythe and her pretty wrists. Call chose a young white woman named Maggie, who took his coins and accepted him in silence. She had gray eyes. She seemed to be sad. The look in her eye as he was pulling his pants up made him a little uneasy. It was a sorrowful look. He felt he ought to say something, perhaps try to talk to the girl a little, but he didn't know how to talk to her, or even why he felt he should. "Thank you. Goodbye," he said finally.
Maggie didn't smile. She stood at the back of the stall by the quilt she slept and worked on, waiting for the next stranger to come in. Johnny Carthage was waiting when call came out. He had a policy of not buying Mexican women, the reason being that a Mexican whore had stabbed out his eye while trying to rob him.
"Well, what's your opinion? Is she lively?"
Johnny asked as call came out.
"I have no opinion," call said, still troubled by the sorrow in Maggie's eyes.
Gus McCrae moped all afternoon and would do no work. Call, who had become an expert farrier, took it upon himself to shoe the ranger's new horses. He didn't want one of them coming up lame, not on such a long, risky trip. Shadrach showed up while he was working. He was dusty and grizzled. When asked where he had been, Shadrach said he had been west, hunting cougars.
"Dern, when I hunt, I want something that's better eaten than a cougar," Bigfoot informed him.
"I just take the liver," Shadrach said.
"Cougar liver?"
Bigfoot asked in amazement.
"I've heard the Comanches eat the liver out of cougars, but Comanches eat polecats, too. I ain't yet had a polecat, and I hope I never have to eat the liver out of a mountain cat."
"It's medicine," Shadrach said. "Good medicine. I'm likely to see some cougars going across the plains."
"Oh, I guess you start thinking like an Indian, Shad," Bigfoot said.
"The better to fight 'em," Shadrach said.
He went over and dipped his head in a big water trough to get some of the dust out of his long, shaggy hair. Gus finally agreed to help a little with the horseshoeing, but his mind wasn't on his work. If Carl asked for a rasp, Gus would likely hand him an awl or even a nail. Twice he wandered off to visit the general store, but Clara was off on errands. Mr. Forsythe was pleasant to him, but vague about when his daughter might return.
"I can't predict her," he said. "She's like the wind. Sometimes she's quiet, sometimes she's not."
Annoyed at the girl, why couldn't she stay where he could find her? Gus took the best alternative left to him, which was to get drunk. He bought a jug of liquor from a Mexican peddler and sat under a shed and drank it, while Carl finished the horseshoeing. While he was working, a buggy drove by. An old man wearing a military coat was asleep in it. The old man had a red face and was snoring so loudly they could hear him even after the buggy had passed.
"Well, that's Phil Lloyd, the damn sot," Bigfoot said. "He's a general, but he ain't a good one. I doubt we could get enough barrels of whiskey in a wagon to keep Phil Lloyd happy all the way to Santa Fe unless we lope along quick."
Carl decided the military was peculiar. Why make a general out of an old man who couldn't even find his way around? He tried to interest Gus in the question, but Gus could not be bothered by such business.
"She wasn't there," he said several times, referring to Clara.
"I went back twice to visit. She said I might, but she wasn't there either time."
"I expect she'll be there in the morning," Carl said. "You can trot by and say adios. They say we're leaving tomorrow."
"You may be leaving. I ain't," Gus replied. "I ain't leaving tomorrow or any other time."
Carl knew his friend was too drunk to make sense. He didn't press him.
"Let's walk down by the river. I feel restless," Gus said a little later. "That store's closed now. There's no chance to visit until tomorrow."
Carl was happy to walk with him. It was a starry night, and the rangers had just made a good meal off some tamales Blackie Slidell had purchased from a Mexican woman. A little walk would be pleasant. He took his new musket in case they encountered trouble. The Comanches had been known to come right into Austin and take children or even young women. It wouldn't hurt to be armed. They walked a good distance on the bluffs over above the Colorado River. They could see a light out in the water. Somebody was out in a boat.
"Fishing, I expect," Carl said.
Gus was still fairly drunk. "What kind of fool would fish at night? The fish wouldn't be able to see the bait," Gus said.
Then between one step and the next, he suddenly plunged into space. He was so drunk he wasn't frightened. Sometimes when very drunk he passed out. It felt a little like falling. He assumed for a moment that he must be in the process of passing out. The lantern light on the water was spinning, which went with being drunk, too. He felt himself turn over, which is also a feeling he got when he was drunk. Then he saw the river again, but it seemed to him that it was above him. He began to realize that he was falling, through a night so dark that he couldn't see anything. He couldn't even remember what he had been doing before he fell.
"A fish don't need to see, it can smell," Carl said, just before noting to his shock that he was talking to nobody.
Gus McCrae, at his elbow only the moment before, had disappeared. Call's first thought was that an Indian had snatched Gus, though he didn't see how, since he and Gus had only been a step apart. But Buffalo Hump had taken Josh Korn, and he hadn't been far away either. Call whirled around, almost going off the bluff himself. He couldn't see the edge, but he could see the river in the starlight. The river was a good distance down. He realized then that Gus must have fallen. He didn't know what to do. Probably it was too late to do anything. Gus might already be dead, or dying. Call knew he had to get down to him, but he didn't know how to go about it without falling himself. He had no rope, and it was so dark he feared to try and climb down. Then he remembered that during the day he'd seen an old man with a fishing pole making his way down a kind of trail. There was a way down, but he would need a light of some kind if he was going to find it. Call began to run back toward town, staying well clear of the bluff. He was hoping to encounter someone with a light, but it was as if suddenly he were back on the long plain beyond the Pecos. He saw not a soul until he had run all the way back to where the rangers were camped. When he got there, he discovered that the only ranger who wasn't dead drunk was Gimpy Johnny Carthage, the slowest man in camp. Blackie Slidell and Rip Green were so drunk they couldn't even remember who Gus McCrae was. Johnny Carthage was willing, at least. He and Call found a lantern and made their way back to the river. In time, they found a place where they could scramble down the cliff. The problem then was that Call could not tell how far down the bluff they'd walked before Gus fell. With the help of the lantern, though, he could see that the bluff wasn't high enough for a fall to be fatal, unless Gus had been unlucky and broken his neck or his back. Johnny Carthage was fairly stalwart while they were on the bluff, but once down by the river with help far away, his fear of Indians grew to such proportions that he flinched at every shadow. "Indians can swim," he announced, looking out at the dark water. "Who can?" Call asked. He wanted to call out to Gus, but of course if there were Indians near, the calling would give them away. He was afraid Johnny might panic if the risks increased much. "Indians," Johnny said. "That big one with the hump could be right out there in the water." "Why would he be out there this time of night?" Call asked. Mainly he was trying to distract Johnny from his fear by asking sensible questions. "Well, he might," Johnny said. He had a great urge to shoot his gun, although he couldn't see a thing to shoot at. He just had the feeling that if he shot his gun, he might feel a little less scared. To Call's shock and surprise, Johnny suddenly shot his gun. Call assumed that many had seen Indians. Perhaps Buffalo Hump was in the river. Johnny Carthage was 10 years older than he was and more experienced. He might have spotted an Indian in the water somehow. "Did you hit him?" Call asked. "Hit who?" Johnny said. "The Indian you shot at," Call said. Johnny was so scared he had already forgotten his own shot. He remembered wanting to shoot. He felt it would make him less nervous, but he had no memory of actually firing the gun. Gus McCrae couldn't get the stars above him to come into focus. He was lying on his back, a terrible pain in his left ankle, wondering if he was drunk or dead. Surely if he was dead, his ankle wouldn't hurt so badly. But then he wasn't sure. Perhaps the dead could still feel. He couldn't be sure of anything, except that his left ankle hurt. He could hear the lap of water against the shore, which probably meant that he was still alive. He wasn't wet, either. That was good. One of the things he disliked most about rangering was that it very often left him unprotected from the elements. On the first march to the Pecos, he had been drenched several times. Once, crossing some insignificant little creek, his boots had filled with water. When he took them off to empty them, he noticed several of the older rangers laughing, but it wasn't until he tried to put his boots back on that he realized what they were laughing at. He couldn't get his boots back on. His feet, which had just come out of those very boots, wouldn't go back in. They didn't go back in for almost 2 days until the boots had thoroughly dried. Gus remembered the incident mainly because his ankle hurt so. He knew he could never force his foot into a boot, not with his ankle hurting so badly. He would just have to go bootless on that foot for a while until his ankle mended. While he was thinking about the difficulties that arose when you got wet, a gun went off nearby. Gus's thought was that it was an Indian. He tried to roll under a bush, but there were no bushes on the river shore. Even though he disliked being wet, he didn't dislike it as much as he disliked the thought of being taken by an Indian. He started to roll into the water, thinking that he could swim out far enough that the Indians couldn't find him, when he heard nearby the voices of Johnny Carthage and Woodrow Call talking about the very subject he had just been thinking about, Indians.
"Here, boys, it's me," he cried out. "Come fast, I'm right by the bluff."
A moment later, Call and Johnny found him to his great relief.
I was afraid it was that big one, he said when they came with the lantern. He could poke that big lance right through me if he came upon me laying down. Though glad to have found Gus alive, Carl was still not sure exactly what the situation was. Neither was Johnny. The fact that the latter had fired his gun confused them both. Though not quite dead drunk, Johnny was actually less sober than Carl had supposed him to be back at the camp. He had seemed sober in comparison with Blackie and Rip, but now whatever he had drunk seemed to have suddenly caught up with him. He couldn't remember whether he had fired his gun because he had seen an Indian, or whether he had just shot to be shooting. It could even be that the gun had gone off entirely by accident. Carl was exasperated. He had never known a man to be so vague about his own behavior. You shot the gun, he reminded Johnny for the third time. What did you shoot it at, an Indian?
Matilda ate that big turtle, Johnny said.
He was growing rapidly less in command of his faculties. All he could remember of his earlier life was that Matilda Roberts had cooked a snapping turtle in a ranger camp on the Rio Grande. That wasn't tonight, Johnny, Carl insisted. That was a long time back, and I don't know what it's got to do with tonight. You didn't shoot at a snapping turtle, did you? Johnny Carthage was silent, perplexed. Carl couldn't help but be annoyed. They were in a life-or-death situation. Why couldn't the man remember what he shot at? What did you shoot at tonight? He asked again. Gus was feeling more and more convinced that he was alive and well, except, of course, for a damaged ankle.
I hope my ankle ain't broke. It hurts, he said. You might as well let up on Johnny, though. He ain't got no idea why he shot his gun.
I'll have to be hungry to eat a darn turtle, Johnny Carthage said.
It was his final comment of the evening. To Carl's intense annoyance, he lapsed into a stupor and was soon as prostrate as Gus. Now I've got two of you down, Carl said. This is a damn nuisance. Gus was too relieved to be alive to worry very much about his friend's distemper.
I wonder if that girl will be in the store tomorrow, he asked out loud. I sure would like to see that girl again, although my ankle's bad.
Go see her then, Carl said brusquely. Maybe she'll sell you a crutch. When Carl helped Gus hobble back to camp, Johnny Carthage was no help, having passed out drunk near where Gus had fallen. Bigfoot happened to be there, drinking with Long Bill and Rip Green. After a certain amount of poking and prodding, during which Gus let out a yelp or two, Bigfoot pronounced his ankle sprained but not broken. Gus's mood sank. He was afraid it meant that he would not be allowed to go on the expedition. But you wasn't going anyway. You were aiming to stay and marry that girl, Carl reminded him.
No, I aim to go, Gus said. If I could collect a little of that silver, we could live rich if I do marry her.
In fact, he was torn. He had a powerful desire to marry Clara, but at the same time, the thought of watching his companions ride off on their great adventure made him moody and sad.
You reckon Colonel Cobb would leave me because of this ankle? He asked.
Well, I know there's plenty of wagons you could ride in. Sprain's usually better in a week, Bigfoot said. I guess they could put you in that buggy with old Phil Lloyd unless they mean to transport him in a cart.
Ride with a general? Gus asked. I wouldn't know what to say to a general.
You won't have to say a word to Phil Lloyd. He'll be too drunk to talk, Bigfoot assured him.
The next morning, the sprained ankle was so swollen Gus couldn't put even a fraction of his weight on it. The matter chagrined him deeply. He had hoped to be at the general store at opening time in order to help Miss Forsythe with her unpacking. Yet even standing up was painful. Needles of pain shot through his ankle.
I expect they have liniment in that store, Carl told him. I guess I could walk up there and buy you some liniment.
Oh, you would, Gus said, agitated at the thought that Carl would get to see Clara before he did. I suppose you want to help her unpack dry goods, too.
What? Carl said, puzzled by Gus's annoyance. Why would I want to help her unpack? I don't work in that store.
Bear grease is best for sprains, Long Bill informed him.
Well, do we have any?
Gus asked, eager to head off Carl's trip to the general store.
Why, no, I don't keep any, Long Bill said. Maybe we can scrape a little up next time we kill a bear.
I seen a bear once eating a horse, Gus remembered. I didn't kill him, though.
Carl grew tired of the aimless conversation and walked on up to the store. The girl was there, quick as ever. She wasn't unpacking dry goods, though. She was stacking pennies on a counter, whistling while she did it.
Be quiet. Don't interrupt me, she said, throwing Carl a merry glance. I'll have to do this all over if I lose my count.
Carl waited patiently until she had finished tallying up the pennies. She wrote the total on a little slip of paper.
"So it's you, and not Mr. McCrae," she said when she was finished. "I rather expected Mr. McCrae. I guess he ain't as smitten as I thought."
"Oh, he's mighty smitten," Carl assured her. "He meant to be here early, but he fell and hurt his ankle."
"Just like a man." "Is it broke?" Clara asked. "I expect he done it dancing with a senorita. He looks to me like he's the kind of Texas Ranger who visits the senoritas."
"No, he fell off a bluff," Carl said. "I was with him at the time. He's got a bad sprain and thought some liniment might help."
"It might if I rubbed it on myself," Clara said. Carl was plain embarrassed. He'd never heard of a woman rubbing liniment on a man's foot. It seemed improper to him, although he recognized that standards might be different in Austin.
"If I could buy some and take it to him, I expect he could just rub it on himself," Carl said.
"I see you know nothing of medicine, sir," Clara said, thinking she had never met such a pompous young fool as Mr. Woodrow Carl.
"Well, can I buy some?" Carl asked.
He found it tiring to do so much talking, particularly since the girl's manner was so brash and her attitude so confusing.
"Yes, here. We have the best liniment of any establishment in town," Clara said. "My father uses this one. I believe it's made from roots."
She handed Carl a big jar of liniment, charging him 20 cents. Carl was dismayed at the price. He hadn't supposed liniment would cost more than a dime.
"Tell Mr. McCrae I consider it very careless of him to go falling off a bluff without my permission," Clara said as she was wrapping the jar of liniment in brown paper. "He might have been useful to me today if he hadn't been so careless."
"He had no notion that he was so close to the edge, miss," Carl said, thinking that he ought to try and defend his friend.
"No excuses. Tell him I'm very put out," Clara demanded. "Once I smite a man, I expect more cautious behavior."
When Carl reported the conversation to Gus, Gus blamed it all on him.
"I suppose you informed her that I was drunk. You aim to marry her yourself, I expect," Gus said in a temper.
Carl was astonished by his friend's irrationality. "I don't even know the woman's name," he told his friend.
"Pshaw, it don't take long to learn a name," Gus said. "You mean to marry her, don't you?"
"You must have broke your brain when you took that fall," Carl said. "I don't intend to marry nobody. I'm off to Santa Fe."
"Well, I am, too. I wish I'd never let you go up to that store," Gus said.
He was tormented by the thought that Clara Forsythe might have taken a liking to Carl. She might have decided she preferred his friend, a thought so tormenting that he got up and tried to hobble to the store. But he could put no weight on the wounded ankle at all. It meant hopping on one leg, and he soon realized that he couldn't hop that far. Even if he had, what would Clara think of a man who came hopping in on one leg? He was forced to lie in camp all day, sulking, while the other Rangers went about their business. Long Bill Coleman grew careless with the jug of whiskey he had procured the night before. While he was trying to repair a cracked stirrup, Gus crawled over to Bill's little stack of bedding, uncorked the jug, and drank a good portion of it. Then he crawled back to his own spot, drunk. Brognoli, the quartermaster, showed up about that time, looking for men to load the ammunition wagons. Carl and Rip Green were recruited. Gus was fearful Brognoli would remove him from the troop once he found out about the ankle, but Brognoli scarcely gave him a glance.
"You'll be running Buffalo in a few days, Mr. McCrae," Brognoli said. "I'll warn you, though. Be careful of your parts once we're traveling. Colonel Cobb won't tolerate stragglers. If you can't make the pull, he'll leave you, and you'll have to come back as best you can."
Gus managed to sneak several more pulls on Long Bill's jug and was deeply drunk when he woke from a light snooze to see a girl coming toward the camp. To his horror, he realized it was Clara Forsythe. It was a calamity. Not only was he drunk and too crippled to attend himself, he was also filthy from having rolled into a mud puddle during the night. He looked about to see if there was a wagon he could hide under, but there was no wagon.
"There you are. I had hoped you would show up early and help me unpack those heavy dry goods," Clara said. "I see you're unreliable. I might have suspected it." She was smiling as she chided him, but Gus was so sensitive to the fact that he was drunk and filthy that he hardly knew what to do.
"Let's see your foot," Clara said, kneeling down beside him. Gus was startled. Although Carl had informed him that Clara intended to rub liniment on his foot herself, Gus had given the report no credit. It was some lie Carl had thought up to make him feel worse than he felt. No fine girl of the class of Miss Forsythe would be likely to want to rub liniment on his filthy ankle.
"What?"
he asked. He was so drunk that he could hardly stammer.
He wished now that he had not been such a fool as to drain Long Bill's jug.
But how could he possibly have expected a visit from Miss Forsythe? Only whores prowled around in the rough ranger camps, and Clara was clearly not a whore.
I said, let's see your foot, Clara said. Did the fall deafen you, too?
No, I can hear, Gus said. What would you want with my foot? He asked.
I need to know if I think you're going to recover, Mr. McCrae, Clara said with a challenging smile. If you do recover, I might have plans for you, but if you're a goner, then I won't waste my time.
What kind of plans? Gus asked.
Well, there's a lot of unpacking that needs to get done around the store, Clara said. You could be my assistant if you behave.
Gus surrendered the wounded foot, which was bare and none too clean. Clara touched it gently, cupping Gus's heel in one hand.
The thing is, I'm a ranger, Gus reminded her. I signed up for the expedition to Santa Fe. If I try to back out now, the colonel might call it desertion and have me hung.
Fiddle, Clara said, feeling the swollen ankle. She lowered his foot to the ground, noticed the jar of liniment sitting on a rock nearby, and removed the top.
Well, they can hang you for desertion if they take a notion to, Gus said.
I know that. Shut up, Clara said, scooping a bit of liniment into her hand. She began to massage it into the swollen ankle a dab at a time. My pa thinks this expedition is all foolery, Clara went on. He says you'll all starve once you get out on the plains. He says you'll be back in a month. I guess I can wait a month.
I hope so, Gus said. I wouldn't want no one else to get the job.
Clara looked at him but said nothing. She continued to dab liniment on his ankle and gently rub it in.
That liniment stinks, Gus informed her. It smells like sheep dip.
I thought I told you to shut up, Clara reminded him. If you weren't crippled, we could have a picnic, couldn't we? Gus decided to ignore the comment. He was crippled and wasn't quite sure what a picnic was anyway. He thought it was something that had to do with church-going, but he wasn't a church-goer and didn't want to embarrass himself by revealing his ignorance.
What if we're out 2 months? He asked. You wouldn't give that job to nobody else, would you?
Clara considered for a moment. She was smiling, but not at him exactly. She seemed to be smiling mostly to herself.
Well, there are other applicants, she admitted.
Yes, that damn Woodrow Call, I imagine, Gus said. I never told him to go up there and buy this liniment. He just did it himself.
Oh, no, not Corporal Call, Clara said at once. I don't think I fancy Corporal Call as an unpacker. He's a little too solemn for my taste. I expect he would be too slow to make a fool of himself.
That's right, he ain't foolish, Gus said.
He thought it was rather a peculiar standard Clara was suggesting, but he was not about to argue with her.
I like men who apt to make fools of themselves immediately, Clara said. Like yourself, Mr. McCrae. Why, you don't hesitate a second when it comes to making a fool of yourself.
Gus decided not to comment. He had never encountered anyone as puzzling as the young woman kneeling in front of him with his foot almost on her lap. She didn't seem to give a fig for the fact that his foot was dirty and he himself none too clean.
Are you drunk, sir? She asked bluntly. I think I smell whiskey on your breath.
Well, Long Bill had a little whiskey, Gus admitted. I took it for medicine. Clara didn't dignify that lie with a look or a retort.
What were you thinking of when you walked off that cliff, Mr. McCrae? Clara asked. Do you remember?
In fact, Gus didn't remember. The main thing he remembered about the whole previous day was standing near Clara in the general store watching her unpack dry goods.
He remembered her graceful wrists and how dust motes stirred in a shaft of sunlight from the big front window. He remembered thinking that Clara was the most beautiful woman he had ever encountered, and that he wanted to be with her. Beyond being with her, he could conceive of no plans. He had no memory of falling off the cliff at all, and no notion of what he and Woodrow Call might have been discussing. He remembered a gunshot and Call and Johnny finding him at the base of the bluff, but what had gone on before or been set up on the path he couldn't recall.
"I guess I was worrying about Indians," he said, since Clara was still looking at him in a manner that suggested she wanted an answer.
"Shucks, I thought you might have been thinking of me," Clara said. "I had the notion I'd smitten you, but I guess I was wrong. I haven't smitten Corporal Call, that's for sure."
"He ain't a corporal, he's just a ranger," Gus said, annoyed that she was still talking about Call. "He didn't trust the man, not where Clara was concerned, at least."
"Why, that's better. Perhaps I have smitten you."
She closed the jar of liniment, eased his foot to the ground, and stood up.
It does smell a little like sheep dip, that's accurate, she said. What do you gentlemen use to wash with around this camp?
Nothing. Nobody washes, Gus admitted. Sometimes we wash in a creek if we're traveling, but otherwise we just stay dirty.
Clara picked up a shirt someone had thrown down and carefully wiped her fingers on it. I hope the owner won't mind a little sheep dip on his shirt, she said.
That's Call's extra shirt. He won't mind, Gus assured her.
Oh, Corporal Call. Where is he, by the way? Clara asked.
He ain't a corporal, I told you that, Gus said. He found her use of the term very irritating. That she felt the need to refer to Call at all was more than a little annoying.
Nonetheless, I intend to call him Corporal Call, and it's not one bit of your business what I call him, Clara said pertly. I'm free to choose names for my admirers, I suppose. Gus was so annoyed that he didn't know what to say. He sulked a bit, thinking that if Call were there, he'd give him a punching, sore ankle or no sore ankle.
Well, goodbye, Mr. McCrae, Clara said. I hope your ankle improves. If you're still in camp tomorrow, I'll come by and give it another treatment.
I don't want a crippled assistant, not with all the unpacking there is to do. To his surprise, she reached down and gave him a handshake. Her fingers smelled of the liniment she had just rubbed on him.
We're supposed to pull out tomorrow. I hope we don't, though, Gus said.
You know where the store is, Clara said. I certainly expect a visit before you depart. She started to leave and then turned and looked at him again. Give my respects to Corporal Call, she said. It's a pity he's not more of a fool.
If he's a corporal, I ought to be a corporal too, Gus said, bitterly annoyed by the girl's manner.
Corporal McCrae. No, that don't sound right, Clara said. Corporal Call, somehow that has a solid ring. Then with a wave, she walked off. When Call came back to camp in the evening, sweaty from having loaded ammunition all day, he found Gus drunk and boiling. He was so mad his face turned red and a big vein popped out on his nose.
She calls you a corporal, you rascal, Gus said in a furious voice. I told you to stay clear of that store. If you don't, when I get well, I'll give you a whip and you'll never forget.
Call was taken completely by surprise, and Long Bill, Rip Green, and a new recruit named Jimmy Tweed, a tall boy from Arkansas, were all startled by Gus's belligerence. Jimmy Tweed had not yet met Gus and was shocked to find him so quarrelsome. Call didn't know what reply to make, and so said nothing. He had known that sometimes people took fevers and went out of their heads. He supposed that was what was the matter with Gus. He walked closer to see if his friend was delirious, and was rewarded for his concern with a hard kick in the shin. Gus, though in a prone position, had still managed to get off the kick.
"Why, he's unruly, ain't he?" Jimmy Tweed said. "I expect if he wasn't crippled, we'd have to chain him down."
"I don't know you. Stay out of it," Gus warned. "I'd do worse than kick him if I could."
"I expect it's a fever," Call said, at a loss to explain Gus's behavior any other way. Before the dispute could proceed any further, Bigfoot came loping up on a big gray horse he had just procured.
"Buffalo Hump struck a farm off toward Bastrop," he said. "An old man got away and spread the news. We're getting up a troop to go after the Indians. You're all invited except Gus and Johnny. Hurry up. We need to ride while the trail's fresh."
"Why ain't I invited?" Johnny Carthage asked. He had just limped into camp.
"Because you got to do the packing," Bigfoot said. "The expedition's leaving early. I doubt we'll be back. You got to get all this gear together and pack Gus into a cart or wagon or something. We'll meet you on the trail, if we survive."
"This is a passel of stuff for one fellow to pack," Johnny observed bleakly. "Gus won't be no help either. He's poorly."
"Not poorly enough. He just kicked my leg half off," Call said. The more he thought about the incident, the more aggrieved he felt. All he had done all day was load ammunition. Why did he have to be kicked because of some joke a girl made? Shadrach came trotting up, his long rifle across his saddle. He didn't say anything, but it was clear that he was impatient.
"Let's go, boys. Buffalo Hump will be halfway to the Brazos by now," Bigfoot said. Call had been assigned a new mount that day. As yet, he had barely touched him, but in a minute he was in the saddle. The little horse, a bay, jumped straight up, nearly throwing him. After that one jump, he didn't buck again. Call only had time to grab his rifle and ammunition pouch. Shadrach had already left. Long Bill, Rip Green, and Jimmy Tweed were scrambling to get mounted.
Bigfoot was the only calm man in camp. He reached down without dismounting and grabbed a piece of bacon someone had brought in, stuffing it quickly into his saddlebag.
"There's a passel of stuff to pack up,"
Johnny Carthage said again, looking